Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everybody. First of all, I want to welcome you to the Tattered Cover this evening. My name is Derek, and the person who's just here is Beth. So if you have any questions, you can certainly address them to either of us. I also want to thank you for coming to support your local independent businesses. It does make a difference, so thank you for that. And tonight we have a real treat. I'm very excited for tonight. Tonight we have one of the best translators of science that's out there. And there's science has always fascinated me, I'm thinking everybody in the room, and there's nothing more fascinating than what goes on between my two ears and what's going on between the ears of everyone else. Loved the book, How We Decide. Now I'm loving the book, Imagine How We Create. And how those ideas come to us from Pixar to jazz musicians to how brainstorming works and doesn't work, why the color blue is important, all those kinds of questions. Those are things that tonight's author deals with in his latest book. I can talk about the different places where tonight's author is contributing, both online, in print, on radio, but I'm thinking most people have already heard those. So I'm just going to get out of the way right now and introduce and hope you will help me welcome Jonathan Lehrer.
Thank you so much, everyone, for coming tonight. It is such a pleasure to be here in this wonderful independent bookstore. I have heard so much about this place, so it really is a special thrill to be here tonight. I'd like to begin with a story about Bob Dylan. It takes place in the early summer of 1965 when Dylan is finishing up his tour of England. It's been a grueling few months as Dylan has been struggling to maintain a nonstop performance schedule. He'd first traveled across the Northeast on a bus, playing in small college towns and big city theaters. Then he crossed over to the West Coast and crammed in a few hectic weeks of concerts and promotion. He'd been paraded in front of the press and asked an endless series of inane questions, from "What is the truth?" to "Why is there a cat on the cover of your last album?" When Dylan was in Surly, he was often sarcastic, telling journalists that he collected monkey wrenches, was born in Mexico, and that his songs were inspired by chaos, watermelon, and clocks. That last line almost made him smile. But by the time Dylan arrived in London, it was clear that the tour was taking a toll. The singer was skinny from insomnia and pills, his nails were yellow from nicotine, and his skin had a ghostly pale pallor. Joan Baez said he looked like an underfed angel. For the first time, his solo shows felt formulaic, as if he were singing the lines of someone else. He rarely acknowledged the audience or paused between songs. He seemed to be in a hurry to get off stage. Before long, it all became too much. While touring in England, Dylan decided that he was leading an impossible life. The only talent he cared about, his ceaseless creativity, was being ruined by fame. The breaking point probably came after a brief vacation in Portugal, where Dylan came down with a vicious case of food poisoning. The illness forced him to lie in bed for a week, giving him a rare chance to reflect. "I realized I was very drained," Dylan would later confess. "I was playing a lot of songs I didn't want to play. I was singing a lot of words I didn't really want to sing. It's very tiring having other people tell you how much they dig you if you yourself don't dig you." The last shows were in London. It was here that Dylan told his manager he was quitting the music business. He was finished with singing and songwriting and was going to move to a tiny cabin in Woodstock, New York. Although Dylan had become a pop icon, the prophetic poet of his generation, he was ready to renounce it all. He just wanted to be left alone. Dylan wasn't bluffing. As promised, he returned from his British tour and rode his Triumph motorcycle straight out of New York City. He didn't even bring his guitar. Of course, our story does not end here. Bob Dylan did not retire in 1965. After a few relaxing days in Woodstock, just when Dylan was most determined to stop creating music, he was overcome with a familiar feeling. It's a hard thing to describe, Dylan would later remember, just the sense that you got something to say. So Dylan did the only thing he knew how to do. He grabbed a pencil and started to scribble. Once Dylan began, his hand didn't stop moving for the next several hours. I found myself writing this song, this story, this long piece of vomit, 20 pages long, Dylan said. I'd never written anything like that before, and it suddenly came to me that this is what I should do. Vomit is the essential word here. Dylan is describing with characteristic vividness the uncontrollable rush of a creative insight, that flow of associations that simply can't be held back. I don't know where my songs come from, Dylan said. It's like a ghost is writing the song. It gives you the song and it goes away. You don't know what it means. In retrospect, we can see that this frantic composition in Woodstock, these words written by the ghost, allowed Dylan to fully express for the very first time the full diversity of his influences. In these cryptic lyrics, we can hear his mental blender at work as he mixes together scraps of Blake, Fellini, Brecht, Woody Guthrie, and Robert Johnson. The song is modernist and pre-modern, avant-garde and country western. What Dylan did, and this is why he's Bob Dylan, is find the strange thread connecting these different voices. In those frantic first minutes of writing, he found a way to make something new out of this incongruous list of influences, drawing them together into a catchy song. When Dylan gets to the chorus and he knows this is the chorus, as soon as he commits it to paper, the visceral power of his words become obvious. How does it feel to be without a home, like a complete unknown, like a rolling stone? The following week, on June 15th, 1965, Dylan brings the sheaf of papers into the cramped space of Studio A at Columbia Records in New York City. After just four takes, the musicians were only beginning to learn their parts. Like a Rolling Stone was cut on acetate. Those 6 minutes of raw music would revolutionize rock and roll. Bruce Springsteen would later describe the experience of hearing the single on the radio as one of the most important moments of his life. The story of Like a Rolling Stone, the reason I'm talking about Bob Dylan tonight, is because it's a story about a moment of insight. At times, such stories can feel like romantic cliches, the sort of make-believe breakthroughs that happened to Archimedes in the bathtub and Isaac Newton under the apple tree. And yet, insights do happen. They are a genuine mental event. They really are responsible for the theory of gravity and Like a Rolling Stone. In recent years, psychologists and neuroscientists have made some interesting progress in trying to understand these very, very mysterious mental moments, these moments of insight. It turns out there are two defining features of such moments of insight. The first defining feature is that the answer comes out of the blue. It arrives when we least expect it. So we write our best song after we quit the singing and songwriting business. The second defining feature is that as soon as the answer arrives, we know this is the answer. We don't have to look through these lyrics. We don't have to double check the math, think about the alternatives. We know this is the solution we've been searching for. So it comes attached with this sense of certainty. It feels like a revelation. Now, at first glance, it's not exactly clear how one could scientifically study such moments of insight, you know, because you can't just put undergraduates in a brain scanner and say, have an epiphany, we're ready for you. That would be a very inefficient way to collect data. So instead, what scientists had to do is come up with a way to generate lots of moments of insight on the fly. And I'm talking tonight primarily about the research of Mark Beeman at Northwestern and John Kunios at Drexel. And they pioneered a set of word problems called compound remote associate problems. The acronyms are a bit unfortunate, C-R-A-P. You can imagine how tired the scientists are of this joke. But the word problems go like this. We'll do the first one together. I'm going to give you three words, and you have to find the fourth word that can form a compound word with these three. So the three words are pine, crab, and sauce. The answer here is apple, pineapple, crab apple, applesauce. If you solve pine, crab, and sauce, apple will probably pop into your head in a sudden blinding flash, like a light bulb flicked on inside your cortex. So here's one for you guys. The three words are age, mile, and sand. What's the fourth word that can form a compound word with age, mile, and sand? Just shout it out if you got it. Stone. This is a very creative group. Either that or you read the book. But the answer is stone, stone age, milestone, sandstone. So the first thing Beeman and Kunis discovered when they gave people these compound remote associated problems inside an fMRI machine is that in the seconds before an insight appeared, a part of the brain called the anterior superior temporal gyrus lit up. This is an obscure bit of the brain nobody knows too much about. It's in the back of the right hemisphere, just behind your ear. It's been previously associated with things like the processing of jokes and the interpretation of metaphors. And this begins to make a little sense. You know, when we're watching Romeo and Juliet and Romeo says that Juliet is the sun, we know he's not saying that Juliet's a big flaming ball of plasma gas. Instead, we realize he's trafficking in metaphor. Now, the way we make sense of that metaphor is by looking past all the surface dissimilarities, the fact that Juliet and suns have literally nothing in common, and instead searching for those remote associations, those underlying themes they actually share. And so we can figure out that Juliet is saying that Romeo is saying that Juliet lights up his world the way the sun lights up ours. Now, a similar mental process is required when you're trying to make sense of pine, crab, and sauce. Those aren't three words that go together very frequently, and what this one brain area in the back of your right hemisphere seems to be particularly good at is finding that one other word, which in this case is apple, which binds them all together. Now, this same mental process is often going to be required when you need a moment of insight, when you're trying to solve a very, very difficult problem. Because if the connections were obvious, if it was clear how to bring these ideas together, how to solve this problem, chances are you would have solved it already. You wouldn't be searching in vain for an epiphany. And that's why when you need a moment of insight, when you're solving a real problem in the real world, you're often going to rely on the anterior superior temporal gyrus. So that's the first thing Beeman and Kunis discovered, is the importance of this brain area in the back of your right hemisphere for solving moments, for generating moments of insight. The second thing they discovered is a bit more interesting. This they discovered when they hooked people up to an EEG machine. It's like wearing a big bulky shower cap that measures the waves of electricity pouring out of your head. And what Beeman and Kunis discovered in conjunction with researchers at the University College of London is that they could predict up to 8 seconds in advance whether or not someone was going to have a moment of insight. So now just think for a second how spooky this is. They could look at your EEG waves and they could say, sorry, buddy, you are wasting your time. You could sit here all day and you're just not going to have an epiphany. You should save us all out of trouble and frustration. Just go home. Or they could say, you know what, in about 7.5 seconds, the odds are looking pretty good that you're going to have a breakthrough. So brace yourself. The question, of course, is what this predictive signal is. Turns out to be something called alpha waves. Like most things in the mind, alpha waves remain pretty mysterious, but they are very closely associated with states of relaxation. So things that lead to the generation of lots of alpha waves are things like taking a lovely hike in nature, taking a hot shower, you know, sitting on the couch drinking a beer, playing ping pong, doing whatever it is you do that puts your mind at ease, that gets you to stop thinking about those nagging problems at work. Now, the reason states of relaxation are so important is that when we're not relaxed, when we're focused, when we've just chugged a triple espresso, our attention's out here. It's out in the real world, right? We are fixated on the problem. We're thinking about pine, crab, and sauce. And it's probably a wrong answer. A common wrong answer for pine, crab, and sauce is tree, that we just can't get past. We can't forget about it. And so we're stuck. We're horribly frustrated. The problem feels impossible. And that's why relaxation is so important, because it's not until you're relaxed in the shower, those alpha waves humming in your head, that you're finally able to turn the spotlight of attention inwards while shampooing your hair. And that's when at long last you hear that quiet voice coming from the back of your head telling you, the answer is apple. The answer is apple. Maybe that voice has been there for hours or days or weeks. You just haven't taken a moment to listen. Now, there is something counterintuitive about this research. I think most people assume that when faced with a very difficult problem, that what you need to do is to double down on concentration, to get juiced on caffeine and chain yourself to your desk and stay late at the office while staring at your computer screen. But that turns out to be exactly backwards. You will be focused, but you will be making absolutely no progress. Instead, the next time you're faced with a very, very difficult problem, you need to find a way to escape. You need to go on vacation. You take a very long hot shower. You need to go for a long hike. The answer will only arrive after you stop searching for it. There's this wonderful line of Einstein's where he said, creativity is the residue of wasted time. The next time you're faced with a very, very hard problem, next time you need a moment of insight, you have to make time to waste time. Now, I wish I could stand up here and tell you that the way to solve every creative problem is to relax, to take a hot shower, to drink a delicious Colorado craft beer on the couch. In fact, just last month, a study came out. This reminds me, pardon the digression, but a study came out showing that when you get undergrads very drunk, so too drunk to drive, so more than a little tipsy, that they actually solve 30% more of these very difficult creative problems. And that gets back to attention and the virtues of relaxation, that when you are drunk, you are more relaxed. You are better able to engage in daydreaming and mind wandering, and that's a very effective mental state for having those moments of insight. And you're listening to those voices inside your head, to all those answers bubbling up from the unconscious. So you definitely don't want to drive while drunk. You definitely don't want to take a math test while drunk, but it may actually help with the generation of moments of insight. But of course, as I was saying, you know, being drunk isn't the ideal state for all forms of creativity. Relaxation is not a universal cure. Sometimes we have to put in the work. There really is no shortcut around that. As Nietzsche once observed, creators have a vested interest in our believing in the flash of revelation, the so-called inspiration or insight shining down from heavens as a ray of grace. But this is often a lie. In reality, all great artists and thinkers are great workers. To illustrate his point, Nietzsche described Beethoven's musical notebooks, which documented the composer's painstaking process of refining his melodies. It wasn't uncommon for Beethoven to experiment with 70 different versions of a single musical phrase before settling on the final one. I make many changes after my good ideas and reject and try again until I'm satisfied, the composer remarked to a friend. In other words, even Beethoven, the cliché of artistic genius, still needed to constantly refine his ideas, struggling with his music until the beauty shone through. Let's not sugarcoat, this rejecting process is not fun. It's the red pen on the page and the discarded sketch, the trash prototype, and the failed first draft. Nevertheless, such a merciless process is sometimes the only way forward. We keep on thinking and paying attention because our next thought might be the answer. So what defines this grueling kind of creativity? What allows some people to go through 70 different versions of a single musical phrase, to struggle through draft after draft, to simply refuse to quit? Well, first glance, it's really not clear. When you look at people on the far right side of the creative bell curve, these epic creators like Bob Dylan, Pablo Picasso, Steve Jobs, and you try to figure out what makes them so special, what makes them different from the rest of us, it's really not clear. You know, you can give them an IQ test, and it turns out they're not smarter than the rest of us. Their IQs are often perfectly normal. And you can give them the battery of old-fashioned personality tests, Myers-Briggs and all the rest. And once again, they look pretty ordinary. They may be a little bit more open to experience, but that's about it. Instead, I think the answer here, the answer we're searching for, the defining trait that separates epic creators from you and me, is a new character trait called grit. G-R-I-T. These people, they simply refuse to quit. They are more persistent. They simply continue to persevere, even when the going gets tough. I'm thinking here of J.K. Rowling, who suffered through 12 rejections from publishers, but kept on writing about this boy wizard in coffee shops while her baby daughter napped. These creators, these epic creators, they are more stubborn. The best way to explain the importance of grit is to tell you a story about supermarket cashiers. A story that takes place in 1982 and involves a psychologist named Paul Sackett, now at the University of Minnesota. And he was approached by a big supermarket chain who asked him to come up with a way to measure the speed of their cashiers. Sackett thought about this for a second and said, oh, that's easy. He filled a shopping cart with items, asked all these cashiers to check out all these items in the shopping cart. There were 100 items. And he stood there with a stopwatch and he simply timed how long it took them. And sure enough, when you give this test to 800 cashiers, you find that some cashiers are much faster than others, and you get this bell curve of human performance. So Sackett turns over this bell curve and says, look, I have ranked all your cashiers from fastest to slowest. My job is done. But Sackett can't stop thinking about the problem, because he realized that about this time that the supermarkets had introduced electronic scanners, and that if he got access to the scanner data, to, you know, these machines that allow you, it's like a bit like magic. You just wave the UPC symbol and they just scan it like that. If he got access to the scanner data, then he'd be able to measure the speed of cashiers over the course of an hour, a day, a week, without having to give them any test. You know, if the test was a measure of maximal performance, how fast these guys could go when they really wanted to go fast because their boss was standing there and they knew they were being tested, well, Sackett realized he could get access to a measure of typical performance, how they did when they didn't even think they were being tested at all, when they didn't even know they were being measured. So Sackett gets access to the scanner data, and sure enough, he generates another bell curve of cashier performance. Some cashiers are much faster than others over the course of a day, a week, a month. And then he has the bright idea to compare these two bell curves. To, on the one hand, compare his rankings from the maximal test to his rankings from this typical measure of performance. And what he discovers is that the correlation is essentially zero. It's just below 0.1, but it's statistically insignificant. This is known as the maximal typical distinction. What Sackett has shown in field after field is that even though we live in a society obsessed with maximal tests, right? When we want to evaluate someone's talent, we give them a maximal test. It's from the IQ test to the SAT to all these tests we give to prospective employees, that in field after field, these maximal tests fail to predict what we actually care about, which is typical performance, which is how people do in the real world. My favorite example of the maximal typical distinction comes from the NFL Combine. The NFL Combine is this two-day carnival of maximal tests that every player entering the NFL draft has to attend. So you give all these draftees, you know, 40-yard dashes, bench press tests. You see how high they can leap. You give them a short version of the IQ test called the Wunderlich. The assumption of NFL teams is that performance at the Combine will determine how they do in the pros. So players who do really well at the Combine, they go higher in the draft. They make a lot more money. Well, two economists at the University of Utah last year decided to actually see if the Combine is useful. And what they discovered is that based on the correlations between these maximal tests and typical performance on the field in the pros, the NFL Combine is a massive waste of time and money. That all those maximal tests are completely useless. They tell you nothing about how players do in the NFL. The sole exception is the 40-yard dash and running backs. Every other maximal test, totally useless. Now, the reason there is so often this distinction between maximal tests and typical performance returns us to the importance of grit. Maximal tests, they're often really good at measuring talent, you know, innate talent, seeing how good we can be when we really want to do well. But in the real world, success isn't just about talent, right? The equation of success is talent plus effort. Maximal tests can't measure effort. Grit, this new character trait, it's all about effort. It's all about how you do over the course of putting in those 10,000 hours of deliberate practice. It's about how you react to frustration and failure over the long term. It's not about some short high-stakes test. It's about the macro timescale, about those years and years of practice, those years and years of effort that are required to make something new. The character trait grit was actually pioneered by a psychologist named Angela Duckworth. She's now at Penn, and she first developed it in 2005 in conjunction with West Point. You see, West Point had this problem. For decades, they lost about 5% of their cadets within the first 6 weeks. So, you know, it's known as Beast Barracks. It's a very difficult time. It's when you get your head shaved and you get woken up early and you go on long runs or trying to convert soft citizens into hardened soldiers. And so West Point was losing a lot of cadets right off the bat. And this was a big problem for West Point because there are no transfer students. So these are future leaders of the Army you want to groom, and they are just vanishing. So West Point had tried in vain to predict retention, looking for all sorts of maximal measures that would allow them to figure out who would actually make it through the first 6 weeks. Nothing worked. They looked at SAT scores. That didn't work. Measured the physical fitness. That didn't work. So in desperation, they approached Angela. She came up with this simple survey she called the Grit-O Survey. It asked questions. It asks questions in two different domains. The first domain is, how single-minded are you about your goal? Have you always wanted to go to West Point? Have you always wanted to be a novelist, be a painter, be a computer scientist? Whatever your goal is, have you had it for a while? Do you believe in it? Are you serious about it? The second domain is, how do you react to the frustrations that are going to happen as you try to accomplish this goal? Are they a sign that you should double down and try even harder? Or are they a sign that you're just not cut out for this, that you should find a new goal, try something new? Those are the sorts of questions she asks. And what Duckworth discovered is that her short grid-O survey is the first test West Point had ever used that actually allowed them to predict retention. They've used it every year since. It works every single year. Now, since 2005, Duckworth has gone on to show that in field after field, domain after domain, levels of grit are the single biggest predictor of success. So if you're trying to figure out which 12-year-old is going to win the National Spelling Bee, not the smartest 12-year-old, not the 12-year-old with the best grades, the one with the highest levels of grit. Why? Because grit mediates deliberate practice. Grit allows you to practice the right way, which is not the fun way. If you're trying to figure out which teachers are going to make it a Teach for America, going to, you know, each of the biggest standardized test gains for their students and going to make it through the first year. It's not the ones with the highest SAT scores. It's the ones with the highest levels of grit. Trying to figure out which amateur golfer is going to make it to the PGA Tour, the ones with the highest levels of grit. Which graduates of the Wharton Business School are going to make the most money 3 years out, the ones with the highest levels of grit. Now, Duckworth argues that levels of grit are particularly important in the creative world simply because making something new is never going to be easy, right? If it were easy, that idea would already exist, that novel would have been written, that poem would have been published, that gadget would have been patented. So if you want to create something new, if you want to be a successful inventor, you're going to have to deal with those endless drafts. You're going to have to be a bit like Beethoven, suffering through 70 different versions of a single musical phrase. You're going to have to be willing to persist and persist and persist, to struggle through failed prototype after failed prototype. That's what it takes. Woody Allen has this wonderful quote that 80% of success is simply showing up. Well, grit is what allows you to show up again and again. So far, I've been attempting to describe these two distinct forms of creativity, which depend on very distinct mental processes in the brain. The more practical lesson, though, is that different kinds of creative problems benefit from different kinds of creative thinking. The question, of course, is how to adjust our thought process to the task at hand. When should we daydream and take warm showers, and when should we drink another cup of coffee? What requires relaxation, and what requires grit? The good news, and this is very good news, is that the human mind has a natural ability to diagnose our problems, to assess the kind of creativity we need. These assessments have an eloquent name. They're called feelings of knowing, and they occur whenever we suspect that we can find the answer if only we keep on thinking about the question. One of my favorite examples of a feeling of knowing is when a word's on the tip of your tongue. It's such an annoying mental phenomenon. You know, you're walking down the street and you see someone and you know their name, but you just can't quite remember it. It's on the tip of your tongue. I mean, on the one hand, this is so frustrating. It's a mental hiccup that drives me crazy, but it's also kind of profound, right? Because how do you know something if you don't actually know it? Why are you so convinced that memory's in your head in one of those overstuffed filing cabinets if you can't actually find the file? Well, here's where feelings of knowing prove essential. A feeling of knowing is a reminder telling you, if you just keep on searching for that name, you will eventually recover it. Maybe in 5 minutes, maybe in 10 minutes, but you should keep on searching because the answer is within your reach. Now, when it comes to creative problem solving, these feelings of knowing are often essential. Numerous studies have demonstrated that the human mind is remarkably accurate, up to 90% accuracy, at assessing the likelihood that a problem can be solved. We can glance at a question and know that the answer is within our reach if only we put in the work. The end result is that we're motivated to stay focused on the challenge. Now, what makes these feelings of knowing even more useful is that they come attached with a sense of progress. This was best demonstrated by Janet Metcalf at Columbia University. She gave undergrads a wide variety of creative problems. And what she discovered is that problems that were typically solved in a moment of insight, so problems like those compound remote associate problems, that there were no feelings of knowing. People went straight from freezing cold to burning hot. They got the answer, but there was no sense of progress. However, when she gave people analytical problems that didn't require a moment of insight, people only found the answer after reporting a gradual increase in warmth. Now, what's so impressive about these estimates, these feelings of knowing, what's kind of miraculous, in fact, is that people were able to assess their closeness to a solution without even knowing what the solution was. You know, it's a bit like being dropped in a strange city. You have no idea where the destination is, and yet you're still able to say, if I make this left-hand turn, I'm going to get closer. It is a really weird thing that we can do, and yet it's essential. This ability to calculate progress, even when we don't know the answer, is a very important part of the creative process. When we don't feel that we're getting closer to the answer, we've hit the wall, so to speak, we probably need a moment of insight. In these instances, we should rely on the right hemisphere, which excels at revealing those remote associations. Focusing on the problem will be a waste of mental resources. We will simply stare at our computer screen and repeat our failures. Instead, we should find a way to relax. The most productive thing we can do is forget all about work. However, when those feelings of knowing are telling us that we're getting closer, then we need to keep on struggling. We should continue to pay attention until it hurts, to rely on those muscles of grit. Before long, that feeling of knowing will become actual knowledge. The last idea I'd like to end with is a provocative one, and it speaks directly, I think, to the difficulty of fostering innovation. In fact, it suggests that many of the things we do with the best of intentions, such as holding brainstorming meetings, which don't work, to the hiring of chief innovation officers, that they actually get in the way. They hold back on natural creativity. And this is best demonstrated by the work of Jeffrey West. He's a theoretical physicist at the Santa Fe Institute. He's probably best known for his work on cities. He gathers vast tracts of data from the Census Bureau and the Patent Office and governments all across the world. And he wants to figure out what makes cities tick and why do some cities tick better than others. And he's found all sorts of interesting correlations. One of my favorite correlations is that when you're trying to figure out what makes a city particularly innovative, why some cities generate so many more patents per capita than others, the single most predictive variable is the walking speed of pedestrians. Totally bizarre correlation, right? It could be a total fluke. Nobody knows what to make of it. But West argues that this actually reveals something interesting about why cities are so valuable, that the real function of a city is just to cram people together, right? To facilitate all those knowledge spillovers, all those random conversations we have while waiting in line for a latte on the sidewalk. So in a sense, it's really all about those bumps. Well, people are particles then, right? You can model people as particles and you increase the velocity of those particles. You get those pedestrians to walk a little bit faster, and what's going to happen? You're going to get more bumps. Every once in a while, those bumps are going to lead to a new patent. So that's his theory about walking speed and pedestrians and patents per capita. But West makes this very interesting analogy between cities and companies. He points out that from a certain perspective, cities and companies look very similar, right? They're both big agglomerations of people, big clusters of folks in a fixed physical space, lots of infrastructure and so on. And yet cities and companies exhibit one very interesting difference. Cities never die. Cities are immortal. Cities live forever. You can nuke a city, it's going to come back. You can flood a city, it's going to come back. You can have a devastating earthquake that flattens the city. We still have San Francisco. Companies, on the other hand, are incredibly fragile. The average lifespan of a Fortune 100 company, the biggest companies in the world, these multinational corporations that we assume are going to be around forever, less than 45 years. Only two companies in the original Dow Jones Index are still around. More than 25% of Fortune 500 companies die every decade. So West wants to know, what's the difference? Why do cities live forever and why are companies so fragile? Well, by gathering vast amounts of data, he's found an interesting difference, and the difference is this. As cities get bigger, as a metropolis expands in size, everyone in that city becomes more productive. They're going to make more money, they're going to invent more patents, they're going to invent more trademarks. By every metric of per capita productivity we have, they're going to look smarter and better. This is why cities keep on growing. This is why cities keep on getting bigger. This is why urbanization is the great theme of the 21st century. Companies, on the other hand, look very different. If cities are superlinear, so as they get bigger, their productivity looks like that, companies are sublinear. As a company gets bigger, everyone in that company becomes less productive. They bring in less profit per capita. They invent fewer patents per capita, fewer trademarks. Companies are sublinear. Now, over the long term, this becomes a very serious problem, right? Because Wall Street's always saying, grow the bottom line, get bigger, keep on getting bigger. And so companies get bigger. They hire more people. They get these expensive bureaucracies, expanded fixed costs, but they're no longer innovating at the same rate. So they end up with, they end up becoming more reliant on their old ideas. For new ideas, they've got to make an acquisition. You know, they've got to invest in expensive acquisitions. Every once in a while, those acquisitions won't work out. Those old ideas will no longer prove useful. And that's when companies go belly up. Now, what explains this difference? Why are cities superlinear? Why do cities make us better and companies do the opposite? Well, West argues it's because companies get in the way. The secret of a city is that it's a freewheeling, chaotic place, that mayors can't tell you where to live, they can't tell you who to talk to or what problems to work on. A city is just too many people in a zip code bumping into each other. There's all those serendipitous chats, all those random interactions. That ballet of the sidewalk, as Jane Jacob puts it, that is the magic of the city. Well, companies, they can't be freewheeling. CEOs try to micromanage the creative process. They tell us to brainstorm. They tell us who to talk to. They tell us what problems to work on. They tell us don't take naps. Don't drink beer at work. You know, don't go for long walks. Don't take long showers in the office. They make all these rules. They erect elaborate hierarchies. They silo knowledge. They stifle horizontal interactions and become these very vertical places. And all these things, many of which are done with the best of intentions, they hold us back. They get in the way. So West's advice is simple. When in doubt, imitate the city. In closing, the imagination has always seemed like a magic trick of matter, which is probably why we've always blamed our best ideas on the muses. The good news is that by finally understanding where our new ideas come from, we can have a few more of them. The science of creativity can make us just a little bit more creative. But we must also be honest. The creative process will never be easy, no matter how much we know about neurons or cities. The science of the imagination doesn't fit neatly on a PowerPoint slide, and it can't be summarized in a subtitle. If creativity were that easy, Bob Dylan wouldn't be so famous and grit wouldn't be so important. Despite all the clever studies and rigorous experiments, our most essential talent remains our most mysterious. The mystery is this. Although the imagination is inspired by the everyday world, by its flaws and beauties, we are able to see beyond our sources, to imagine things that only exist in the mind. There was nothing. Now there is something. It's almost like magic. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming tonight and for listening. It's a real pleasure. Thank you very, very much. Thank you. And thank you. And now for my favorite part, your questions, and I will venture my best answers. Yes.
So I want to know how your daily life has changed since you spent so much time on this research. What do you do?
The question is how my daily life has been changed. My creative process has been changed by writing a book about creativity. It's changed in two ways. One, I used to have this kind of puritanical mindset that when I was stuck on a sentence, I didn't know how to structure an article, that I would chug caffeine, I would stay late, I'd force myself to fix it. And of course, you wake up in the morning and you realize that your fixes didn't fix anything, and now you're just hungover on coffee, and you got to begin again, your labor undone. And so for me, I was thrilled to see this research on Moments of Insight, if only because it's a great justification for laziness. You know, now when I'm stuck, I'm much more willing to take a hike and leave my iPhone behind, to just give myself a break. And that's actually been pretty useful. I've actually had some good ideas while just on these daydreaming walks. So that's, I think, probably the single biggest way my day-to-day process has changed. You know, I've also gotten better. I also force myself to just have more of these random conversations. There's an interesting study I describe in the book by Martin Reff where he looked at what predicts entrepreneurial success. So he tracked 766 graduates at the Stanford Business School who had gone on to start their own companies. And what he found is that just about the most predictive variable of entrepreneurial success is the diversity of your social network. So entrepreneurs with more diverse friends, computer scientists who didn't just hang out with computer scientists, they also hung out with novelists and filmmakers and biologists and engineers and all the rest, they were three times more innovative than people with predictable social networks. And he measured innovation in terms of number of patents and amount of revenue from those patents and trademarks and so on. So this really, I think, got me thinking, because I'm not naturally the most extroverted person, but this has inspired me to, when I'm sitting next to you on a plane, fair warning, I'm going to ask you some questions, I always see people kind of, I look at them and start wanting to talk, and I can see them just groan on the inside and put in their earbuds right away. But you know, I do make an effort. And this was kind of brought home to me while even writing the book, because, I was backstage at a conference and was talking to a speaker, and was trying to make small talk just to pass the time, because I just read about this Martin Rev study, and I was like, okay, I should ask him a question. So I ask him a question, and I say, what do you work on? And he says, I work on floor cleaning. And of course, my first response is, oh, floor cleaning. This is why you shouldn't ask strangers questions. Imagining this long conversation about, you know, soap. And then he proceeds to tell me the story of how he invented the Swiffer, which is... I'm a huge Swiffer fan. I've got the whole Swiffer family in my closet, so I was very excited. And that becomes the story I begin the book with. So that brought home in a very personal way the importance of, you know, asking strangers questions, trying to broaden your social network. Yeah.
As kind of a follow-up to that, in writing the book, was your path linear that led you from one research study to the next interesting person, or was it more of an explosion? I mean, did you, once you started researching all these fabulous studies, how did that evolve?
The question is how linear my research process was. It's unfortunately never linear. I really wish it was. And this is, I think, a metaphor for just any creative process. It really is about the serendipity. It's about you're talking to a scientist and they mention offhand as they're shoving you out the door because they're sick of talking to you about, oh, you should talk to my colleague over here who did this great study on Broadway musicals. Like, what? Broadway musicals? And then that intrigues you, and then you end up having that conversation, that actually is exactly what happened to me. And then that study in Broadway musicals by Brian Uzzi is actually one of my favorite studies in the book. So that kind of thing happens again and again. There's simply so much science being done in any given moment that there is no way you can know a field. You know, there is no way to actually make it a linear process. You do your best in the beginning, in that, you know, year and a half I spent researching this study before writing it. But then you're continually surprised, and it's those surprises that are the fun part. So even researching the science isn't linear. In terms of finding the other stories, those Swiffer stories, those Bob Dylan stories, the Pixar stories, there's nothing even remotely linear about that. It sometimes feels like you're just driving in circles. But again, that's the fun part. That's just, you spend time with lots of really, really interesting people, and you ask them lots of silly, naive questions. And sometimes the stories don't work out. I mean, there's, you know, a lot of really fun stuff that was left on the cutting room floor because it just couldn't fit in a book that I wanted to be, you know, somewhat lean. But that's, you know, again, that's pretty fun. It's the fun part of my job. Yes, in back.
I know you mentioned the study of cities, the idea is kind of randomness, and that's what fostering progress, but you certainly wouldn't say that those cities are necessarily more relaxed or less hard working.
Yeah.
No,
in fact, I mean, you see the opposite. So the question is about, to the extent relaxation, the causal mechanisms for this link between relaxation and moments of insight. And you brought up that the more innovative cities are not necessarily the more relaxed ones. And in fact, you could actually argue the opposite, that the reason people are walking faster is because they got places to go to. In terms of the causal mechanisms of relaxation, I would say that relaxation and moments of insight, that particular connection is not about randomness per se. It's really about where our attention is directed, that when we're not relaxed, our attention is directed outwards. When we're more relaxed, we're more likely to direct it inwards. And when you're talking about a largely unconscious mental process, which is what the generation of moments of insight is all about, you know, that's, I think, what makes it feel so mysterious, as if the cortex is sharing a secret with us. These are thoughts and associations that bubble up from the unconscious. That's why, you know, if you give people hard problems and let them engage in REM sleep for a few hours, they're going to wake up and solve 30% more of them, because, like I said, it's an unconscious process in which you are sifting through associations, trying to find those very distant connections. And if it's about accessing those unconscious thoughts that every once in a while bubble up from below, then you want to be relaxed so you can actually listen to it. When you're not relaxed, you know, the noise of the world drowns out those quiet answers coming from below. This is also why daydreaming is so important. The insight may still be there. You're just not listening to it, which is the truly kind of horrifying possibility. In terms of the connection between randomness and creativity, there's this interesting research on attention deficit disorders and creativity, because it turns out that as long as you're high functioning with ADHD, and really that just means you've got a moderately high IQ score, that having attention deficit disorders is a creative blessing, that people with ADHD are several times more likely to be eminent creative achievers. And this is true at all points in the spectrum. So even if you're not diagnosed with ADHD and you just think you're distractible. So, you know, when the air conditioner turns on, you can't help but look up. When you're at a cocktail party, all the conversations taking place around you are really distracting. Those sorts of people, they are seven times more likely to be eminent creative achievers in the real world. And the explanation for why that link exists gets back to randomness, because when you're distractible, you're always reaching for unexpected ideas. You're always being distracted by kind of random effluvia, random stuff that's just, you know, surrounding you. Most of those distractions will be useless. And that's why being a little bit smart will allow you to get rid of them quickly and move on to the next distraction. But every once in a while, you'll grab an idea here and combine it and you'll say, aha, that's interesting. So the link between relaxation and insight is not about the randomness. I think it's really about where the spotlight of attention is directed. But I think there is other interesting research suggesting that, in a sense, randomness does play a role at the individual level as well. Yeah, right there. Great.
At least in my opinion, your studies are really hopeful. Grit, talent, broader networks correlate to success. What are your thoughts on if I define my specific success as getting published and following the path of Jackie Rowling, et cetera, being an entrepreneur and being a Fortune 500, what are your thoughts when I don't reach that level of success?
So the question is, yeah, unfortunately, science doesn't come with a money back guarantee. It would be great if it did, but I think the best way to answer your question, which is about what to do when we keep on feeling like, despite doing the best things, despite making small talk, despite moving to a big city, despite taking lots of hot showers, we still feel like we're failing. I do think the best way to answer that question is to talk more about grit. Simply because, what you find with people like grit is they are able to persist, because just about everyone thinks they're failing at some point. I mean, everyone assumes that this is a low point, I'm not going to make it, and I just got to persist. And a lot of people quit, right? Because it's not fun, and because you're bored, and because you'd rather be doing something else. You realize this comes with an opportunity cost. I'm struggling at this, and I could be doing something else, which seems so much more fun and so much more promising and hopeful. But people who end up becoming those J.K. Rowlings, they don't give up. Now, I think, stupid persistence is not something we should aspire to. Like Duckworth is very eloquent about this. She talks about, we have to do a better job of, especially early on in our childhood, in our career, making sure we've got the right goal. I may want to play in the NBA. In fact, I do want to play in the NBA, but I've got to be honest. All the grit in the world won't get me there. I could practice for 20,000 hours and I still wouldn't be Spud Webb. So we have to make sure we've got the right goal in the first place. But then once we found something we love, once we found this is what I was meant to do, then we have to invest in grit. Duckworth has this wonderful maxim where, when people ask her, how can you build grit up in my 5-year-old, her maxim is, choose easy, work hard. And what she means by that is, it's really important to expose kids and to expose ourselves to a menu of possibilities, to try lots of different things which you might fall in love with. Maybe you fall in love with painting or drawing or writing or being an entrepreneur. And then once you find that thing that doesn't feel like work, that feels like play, you have to remind yourself, work hard. This is not going to be fun. I've got to double down on my grit. I think that's an important reminder. So in a sense, the best way to, I think, build grit up in ourselves, at least until Duckworth has more data, is to remind ourselves that grit is really, really important, which is why it is, in field after field, the single biggest predictor of success. One last question right in front.
Yeah, I'm wondering that that are taking place right now that you're really curious to see what the results are that might lead you to more conclusions?
The question is, are there any studies in progress that I'm really excited about following? Yeah, there is. And I'm talking a lot about grit. But I'm actually writing an article for The New Yorker right now about Angela and her work. So she's kind of on the top of my mind. But she's doing this really interesting longitudinal study where she wants to figure out why some kids have more grit than others. And can we learn from them so that we can turn grit into a teachable skill? And her method of studying this is this is a really depressing set of facts I'm about to unload on you guys, so I apologize. She goes to the Philadelphia District Schools. 45% of kids drop out before they become high school seniors in these schools. She's studying the 55% of kids who stay in. So in a sense, these kids have already made it. They're already kind of a success story. What you find when you look at these kids' standardized test scores is that 95% of them, the longer they stay in school, the worse their test scores get. So they fall farther behind their peers in Pennsylvania. So they look like this. It is so depressing. 5% of these kids, they get better. That despite coming from the same failing educational institutions, despite coming from the same very poor communities, despite often having very little household support, somehow they make themselves better. So what Duckworth has found is that, not surprisingly, these kids score off the chart in grit. They are very, very gritty high schoolers. But she wants to figure out, well, you know, what are their habits? What are their routines? What are their ways of thinking that allow them to be gritty, where they've kind of taught themselves this trait? And she's found some interesting stuff so far. She's just beginning. It's a long longitudinal study. But she's found, for instance, that they are much less likely to think about counterfactuals. So when they're doing their algebra homework, they're not thinking about the ball game on TV. So in a sense, they're a little more thoughtless than most people, because they're not always saying, well, what else could I be doing right now that would be more fun, that would be more interesting? They just think, I need to do my algebra homework, so I will do my algebra homework. And we don't often think of that as an important character trait, but it turns out when it comes to persistence and stubbornness and not quitting, it's really, really important. So those are some of the things she's learning. But so far, it's full of surprises. And so, like I said, she's just beginning it, but I'll be really curious to see what she figures out, simply because I think what we know now is that grit matters. It matters a lot. What we don't know is how to teach it, how to build it up. We've got maxims like choose easy, work hard. I think we've got some intuitions, but I'm excited to learn what she actually learns. Thank you all so much for coming tonight. It's such a pleasure and honor. Thank you very, very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.